Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
You know, not stuck in a rape manor in England, so that's something.
I am obviously not happy that the apocalypse has not yet been canceled. On the other hand, still hopeful.
Still hopeful that we'll all die from the apocalypse. That's what I'm hoping for.
Before Pentecost will come along and save us.
Before we get started with the show, I wanted to fill our loyal listeners in on a special promo we are running as our nation continues into lockdown mode. For a limited time, you get 2 months of access to everything at RebellerMedia.com for free. That's not a nothing Zippo free. You'll find the offer at the top left corner of RebellerMedia.com. I hope you'll check it out. Because the bad news is we're all locked away at home. The good news is if you click on the Originals tab up at the top of the site, we have a treasure trove of content for you to sift through. Last week, we had some really good stuff, including a defense of Peter Berg's Very Bad Things. A little bit more on Peter Berg in a moment. And a nice little retrospective on FX's The Shield, which is the most underrated cop show from our golden age of TV by far. We are paying good money. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope that you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access after the free period ends. Just $2 a month. $2. That's less than most Patreons, and you get so much more bang for your buck. Okay. Up first, controversies and controversies, or as I like to think of it, notes from Hollywood's collapse. We've got good news and bad news this week. Some good news. Those who saw their festival debuts at South by Southwest ruined by the cancellation may kind of sort of get a chance to be on Amazon Prime. Not everyone will partake. In fact, as far as I can tell, nobody's actually partaking. But it's something. Amazon's like, hey, we'll host your movies. You can get them seen by people. It'll be great. Meanwhile, HBO is rolling out hundreds of hours of free content. Shows like The Sopranos will be on there. And across the movie aisle, favorite Sucker Punch will be on HBO for free. Everyone will be able to watch it finally. You can go, you watch it, you go back and listen to Across the Movie Aisle. It's great. Great synergy there. Now, for the bad news, the rise of and reliance on streaming is only bad news for theaters. You see another glimpse of this in the fact that exhibitor AMC had their credit downrated by S&P Global. That company said that the theater giant is likely to run out of cash by midsummer, and it's almost impossible that theaters are going to open by June. Alyssa, given Paramount's decision to put A Quiet Place 2, back on the release map in September, more or less confirming the idea that we are looking at a total shutdown for like 5 to 6 months here, and alongside this streaming boom that we're seeing as more and more people are sitting home watching streaming and getting their content that way, what does the future hold for the theatrical giants trying to stay afloat during these turbulent times?
I mean, I think it's worth remembering that AMC had a lot of debt that it's trying to deal with. And so there's a difference between a company that has no revenue, but also no debt and is able to furlough its employees and sort of generally keep afloat, and a company that has to pay substantial debt service payments, even while it has no money coming in. AMC had substantial debt, so it's going to be in more trouble than places that were not in that position. But yeah, look, it's not a great thing to have one of the country's biggest movie chains in this kind of dire financial danger with no one having any real sense of when theaters are going to reopen. And look, even when theaters do reopen, we have no sense when mass audiences are going to feel comfortable coming back to them. We'll have to see if theaters decide to go all of them to an assigned seating system that staggers people throughout the theater so that people will feel comfortable coming, but where they have to play to, you know, audiences that are maybe a third to a quarter of what they normally would be otherwise. You know, everyone is trying to figure out how to make even the basics work, and movie theaters are a long way away from being allowed to reopen at all, much less figuring out what their new normal will look like. And so I think there's reason to worry. Not everybody's going to survive this. And considering the dire situation that a lot of independent cinemas are in the first place, a lot of people could get to a position where it's not just that their only available movie theater plays nothing but blockbusters, but where their only local option doesn't exist at all. It's really worrisome.
Peter, what do you think? What are we looking at here? My two cents here is that it looks like we are getting more and more likely to seeing some big bankruptcies, but I would be curious to get your take.
We talked about this a month ago or so, right before the apocalypse, when we talked about James Bond being postponed. And, you know, what I said then, in some ways is still what I think, which is just that I've now just upgraded my sense that it is that by the end of this year or next year, it is quite likely that the number of movie screens that are in the United States is going to be down by a very big percentage. I don't know whether that's 20% or whether that's 50%, but I am increasingly finding it hard to see how we get out of this without a bunch of screens closing down permanently, because there's only so long that you can go not having any revenue. There was a stat that went around earlier last week, I think, that where the global box office for the weekend was something like $5,000. I don't know where that $5,000 came from. What movie theater decided to just sell popcorn, you know, out of their as a to-go order, right? And like tell people to go take it home and watch their favorite movie. But $5,000, the previous same year, it had been something like $205 million. So this is just hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, a big percentage of which would have gone to the major, to the theater chains and to independent theaters, that are being completely wiped out forever, that they would be expecting. And, I think A Quiet Place 2 opening in September is honestly pretty hopeful. I don't know that movie theaters, or at least that most movie theaters, will be open in September. And even if a majority of screens are open in the United States in September, I do wonder, as Alyssa said, whether people are going to even be willing to come out to them. Because, you know, on the one hand, people are going to desire a place to go. I think there will be a contingent of people who are just ready to get out of the house and be around other people. I think that is certainly true. But there's going to also be a group of people, and I don't know how big it will be, who are just nervous to go out and go anywhere, especially if you assume that a vaccine is still months away at that point, at best. And this looks potentially like an apocalypse. I mean, an actual kind of end of days for the movie theater business to me. And I just don't know what it looks like coming out the other end.
And I also think that it's important to remember that if movie theaters survive, they may survive in a form that offers audiences a lot fewer choices. Even before all of this happened, the Trump administration was relaxing the so-called Paramount decrees that were intended to stop vertical integration in the movie business so that, you know, studios couldn't own and operate theater chains that would only distribute their movies. And so you can see a scenario where the theater chains survive because Disney or Amazon or Netflix is allowed to buy a bunch of them and then operate them in a fairly anti-competitive way. So I think that, you know, the
I mean, a lot of the big chains are already kind of Disney, Disney houses in some ways, opens their big blockbusters on so many screens. Yeah. I mean, you see a Mulan or a Black Widow, if they had opened, they would have been out on 4,500 screens or something crazy like that.
Yeah, I want to push back on this just a little bit, or at least maybe try to like rejigger our thinking on this, because I do wonder if the real end game here. So The problem that we are looking at in the movie industry is not just with movies, right? Disney has been, you know, up till now, the unassailable king of the mountain. Disney has been, you know, the box office King Kong for the last several many years, and is only looking to consolidate that position. But they can't really take advantage of this, because what are Disney's big businesses, right? Disney's big businesses are movies, which are all closed right now. Their theme parks, which are all closed right now. Their cruise ships, which will be sunk to the bottom of the ocean before we see them rolling out on the high seas again. I think that's an industry that is in much worse shape than movies, frankly. And all of those are closed. So, like, for a while I was thinking, okay, well, who's going to come in and take advantage of AMC's distress and create the first you know, movie chain owned by a studio, the first real big. And I for a while, I thought maybe Disney, like Disney could pick up Regal or AMC. But I frankly don't know that they have the capital or the liquidity right now to do something like that. The second option would be Amazon. And, you know, that is like a very, there's a very interesting sort of synergy that could happen with Amazon there, because one of the things Amazon always looks for in these purchases is real estate. Yeah. And AMC owns a lot of real estate. I mean, some of them are leases, some of them, you know, it kind of depends, but like what would be, you know, kind of a fascinating move is if Amazon, you know, rename AMC the Amazon Movie Company, and you know, you turn those into a distribution hubs for Amazon.com, in addition to being places where you can see Amazon movies. You know, you could, they could make a run at all of the talent that Netflix has amassed, right? Say like, look, Martin Scorsese, we now have 1,000 screens in America.
Yeah. And so we'll both give you streaming on. And Ted Hope, who runs development over there, you know, comes out of the 90s indie world and I think has an investment in the theatrical experience, even if he's working for a streaming giant.
Yeah. This is my question, Peter, would vertical integration be the thing we need right now to save the theatrical experience?
I think that vertical integration could be a thing that helps save it, but vertical integration isn't going to save anything if people won't go or can't go to the movies. And that's the big question right now, is that we don't know how long theaters are going to be forcibly closed. And even after they reopen, whenever that is, whether that's 3 months from now or whether that's 9 months from now, what does reopening look like, both in terms of new rules that the theaters set for legal liability reasons and in terms of audience expectations? Are people going to be too nervous to go sit in a room with hundreds of strangers in a shared group experience? Like I said, I think that there's going to be a kind of divergence of reactions in which some people are just going to rush out and want to spend as much time as possible at bars and as much time as possible in movie theaters and just do all the things that they couldn't do. That will certainly exist. And in some ways, I think it'll probably exist most in urban centers, especially places like New York, where people are stuck in small apartments. At the same time, there are going to be people who are going to wear masks for a long time. There are going to be people who are just going to avoid a lot of types of social interactions for a long time. Maybe not for 10 years, but for 18 months, 2-3 years, enough to really kind of permanently reshape and scar the theatrical exhibitors' business. That said, the thing that I do want to sort of just add in here and make sure we don't forget is this might be the end of movie theaters as we know them, but it's not going to be the end of movies. And what we have seen over the past 5 or 10 years, the last couple of years in particular, is that there is actually, it's completely possible to fund a wide variety of types of movies, both, you know, big action blockbusters and expensive arty films and, you know, populist TV shows that are, you know, designed to just sort of, that are basically page turners and designed to keep you watching, and children's stuff. Movies and filmed entertainment aren't going away because HBO, Netflix, Showtime, FX, AMC, the whole gamut, Amazon, all of these companies have proved that you can actually survive and make really interesting stuff and make a lot of it without any sort of theatrical distribution or without any meaningful theatrical distribution. And that's going to stick around regardless of whether movie theaters are here or not.
Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting question becomes what are all of the spill-on effects on this, right? I mean, you know, there has been a huge dispute between streaming companies and the Oscars in recent years about, you know, what you have to do to qualify for Academy Award nominations. There's also been sort of an ongoing sense that the Academy voters and what they like are diverging from everyday audiences. So what happens when, I mean, I have no idea what happens to the Oscars next year. I mean, there are a ton of movies that are not going to get qualifying runs, and if they get qualifying runs, are not necessarily going to get them in
Here's
front
what
of
I think
nationwide
is gonna happen.
Audiences.
It's going to only be hosts. There's going to be no movies, but instead of no hosts and movies, we're just going to get no movies and only hosts. It's going to be Billy Crystal doing jokes for 4 hours with like a Pixar song sung in the middle of it, or an Eminem performance.
I mean, honestly, that might be an improvement.
Yeah, you would be hard-pressed to do worse than they have kind of been doing recently. Okay, well, that's depressing, as always. But since we're talking about streaming, let's talk about what we're talking about this week. The Netflix original Spencer Confidential. The basic facts of this movie suggest it's the sort of thing that totally would have been released in theaters not long ago. It stars Mark Wahlberg, a big movie star. It's directed by Peter Berg, a director of many big movies, several of which have starred Mark Wahlberg. It's based on a series of books that have amassed a following. It's got pre-awareness. And yet, here it is, dumped on Netflix, beloved by few. It came out a couple of weeks ago. I haven't seen anybody talking about it. Fortunately, we are here to talk about it. Now, part of the reason that it's not beloved is that it's just not that good. It's bland, like skinless, unseasoned chicken. Not terrible exactly, but not memorable in any sort of way. You certainly wouldn't plan an evening around it. Wahlberg plays a cop who gets sent to prison for beating up another cop who he caught in the act of beating his wife. He can't just help it. He just can't help himself. He loves to protect the people. And that extends to clearing the reputation of a cop who was set up by somebody, something about a casino. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I checked out mentally halfway through this movie. It's not complicated, and I still couldn't really follow it just because I was so busy checking my phone and doing other things. There are things that Netflix does very well. They do TV shows well, like Ozarks and Stranger Things and Tiger King, right? They can highlight little-known movies well. They picked up Bloodfather, for instance. We were discussing this before the show, which is a Mel Gibson actioner from 2016 that shot to the top of the Netflix viewing list. They have a little foreign movie called The Platform, which is basically a Cube-style horror movie, kind of a self-contained, cheap horror movie. But what they don't seem to do very well is make these sorts of big-budget, star-driven pictures like Spencer Confidential or Six Underground or Bright, and they don't really have any way to break them into the mainstream of conversation. Sure, people might turn them on while they're folding socks. I'm raising my hand right now. But where is the impact on the culture? Who's talking about these things? And I have some theories about this that we can get into in a minute. But Peter, am I a dinosaur for thinking that it matters that no one is talking about this? Or is Netflix simply winning the war on sleep while I sleep on their strategy?
Well, Netflix seems to think that this kind of movie works for them. Like you, I did not like it very much. I think I may even have liked it less than you. I think it's a kind of ridiculous movie, and it's in some ways hard to believe that it got made, even especially with all of the talent, the genuine talent that is attached to it. But it's interesting that you mentioned Bright, which I think is kind of the model for this sort of film. Bright is a director and star-driven kind of upper-middle-budget action film.
That movie cost $100 million.
So it cost $90 million, but $40 million of that was buying out the back end for the principals. And so it was a $50 million production budget. And we don't know what the budget is for Spencer Confidential, or at least I haven't seen any reports on it. But Netflix thinks Bright did really well. They have commissioned a sequel. They want more of that kind of movie. They have bragged about how well it did for them. And so, part of what one thing that came to mind while I was watching this was I was reading an obituary for the death, I think like the second or third death, of Playboy magazine. And it mentioned, the heyday of Playboy in the 1960s and 70s, the jokes about how, oh, I only read it for the articles. And in fact, if you're a journalist, you know that Playboy did publish quite a bit of really quite good journalism by very good writers. But what Playboy specialized in, this obit pointed out, was B material from great writers. And it pointed to an old Simpsons parody that had an issue of Playboy. The cover was shown, and it was Norman Mailer on martinis was the cover line, right? And that's kind of what Netflix is doing here. They are getting A directors and A talent, and then getting, I think at best, B material out of them. And it's an interesting strategy. I mean, I think Six Underground is the weakest Michael Bay film in a very long time. This is the weakest Peter Berg film in a very long time. Bright is notably worse than some of the other, than most Will Smith films, than the other stuff that the director has done. And
David Ayer.
Yes. And even then Suicide Squad. And I just, I for whatever reason, Netflix seems to like these movies. They seem to get a lot of traction. They give it a kind of they give it an association with talent and with stars that that it wouldn't have otherwise. And my suspicion is that one of the reasons why these aren't great is because Netflix just has a real hands-off approach to its talent. And so it says basically, come in, make this movie. We aren't going to mess with you. We're going to let you make the movie that you want. And so Michael Bay gets to make the most Michael Bay movie that he's ever made. Peter Berg gets to make a film that, you know, if, let's see, imagine that it's a budget that's like Bright's, $50-60 million. He probably wouldn't get to make this movie. I want to jump in here.
I'm sorry. I want to jump in here and just dispute this, because this is actually the least Peter Berg-like movie I can remember seeing in a long time. I mean, this is the sort of movie that I would expect Peter Berg to hand off to a Peter Berg protege who is like, this is his first movie. You know, it is a movie that has no actual style to it, and it has no specifically... Bergian style. I mean, Peter Berg, say what you will,
It has a bunch of slam bang action scenes.
No, it has obvious pop music choices.
It
has a bunch of action scenes that are shot with basic competence and kind of he's kind of holding the camera and letting things happen. Say what you will about the Peter Berg shaky cam affect. None of that is here. He doesn't even, to the point where he doesn't even have like his signature musical tick. What's that band? Fireworks in the Sky or Rockets in the Sky, whatever the kind of like instrumental thing that he always has going over it. This movie has the most generic 70s and 80s action rock arena rock beats that you could imagine. There's just nothing special or interesting about it. And which leads me to think that the whole Peter Berg is taking advantage of this so he can make a super Peter Berg movie is wrong. There's nothing super Peter Berg-y about it.
I don't think it's super Peter Berg-y exactly. I do think it's the kind of movie that he might want to make that he feels like he couldn't make elsewhere. And that's what we consistently get from Netflix's investments in A-list directors, whether that's Alfonso Cuarón making Roma, a movie he probably couldn't make elsewhere, whether that's Martin Scorsese, whether that's Michael Bay with Six Underground. Anyway, Alyssa, I'm actually curious to see what you thought of this. This is your kind of movie, right?
I mean, in a weird way, I found it kind of comforting to watch because it was so blandly terrible. It's like it felt like a dispatch from normality. I mean, if normality was just sort of mediocre. It's sort of a weird movie to watch as someone who grew up in Boston, because it's a very Boston movie in a lot of ways, right? I mean, and not just in the sense that there's a scene of Mark Wahlberg beating up Crooked Cops set to Sweet Caroline, which is like just so, if you put that in a movie that was a parody, like a Boston movie level parody, it would seem really over the top, and it's just hilarious here. And yet it does almost nothing interesting with its Boston-ness, right? I mean, you know, the redevelopment of Wonderland is a real thing, and, you know, has been controversial over the years. Wonderland is itself sort of a, you know, Boston icon. There's an indie movie, Next Stop Wonderland. You know, you have the Red Sox, you have the Bruins, and in Boston, for real, you have interesting tensions between the working class white communities, who are mostly Irish and Italian, and the Black and Latino residents of the city, which is something that sort of shows up in the movie a little bit in a way that feels very sort of color by numbers, but represents a real phenomenon. But the movie just then does nothing with it, right? I mean, you have this sort of repeated line about how Wahlberg's character is never actually going to leave Boston. You know, he's not actually going to go to Arizona and become a truck driver, which, like, obviously, yes. But we never get a sense of what Boston means to him. We don't get a sense of, you know, you have this African-American nurse who's married to a cop, but we don't get a sense of sort of what the racial dynamics on the Boston police force are. You have, again, something that's sort of resonant where you have this kind of corrupt higher up in the police department living in this suburban house. I mean, you've got all the dynamics there, but the movie just doesn't make anything of them. And it's an incredibly generic looking movie visually. I think I G-chatted you guys at some point while I was watching it that it looked like, you know, Pete Berg doing like a Thomas Kincaid painting. So there are all these sort of, you know, overlit shots of the Boston skyline, but it's a totally undistinct movie. That paradoxically,
I think it's a good point that the movie has, in some ways, it's for a movie that is nominally about its setting, it has no sense of place and no interest in investigating the place that it is about.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally this one throwaway line about how, like, Alan Alda's house has appreciated like crazy. And, you know, I have family who live in a house like that that's been converted into condos. Like, that's a real thing. And yet again, there's just, it does nothing with it at all, which is a bummer because you can make, I mean, you know, it's easy to make fun of like Ben Affleck and all the Boston movies, but it is a really interesting small city, and you could do interesting things with it. It's just, this is not that.
Yeah, why would you watch this instead of The Town? I can't, like, The Town is an imperfect film, but it's really a pretty good one in a lot of ways. There's some very sharp performances, great scenes, I mean, really nicely directed action, and it does so much with more with actually very similar material.
Yeah, I mean, why would you watch this instead of The Town or Patriot's Day or Mystic River or Spotlight? I mean, no idea.
Departed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with all of this. And again, this is why I like, I'm surprised that I'm this kind of annoyed by what you said here, Peter. But I find it insane to think that this is the movie that Peter Berg wants to make. Here's what it feels like to me. It feels like a paycheck movie. This feels like a movie where he's like, okay, I can clear, you know, $5 million from Netflix for making this. Whatever. I'll sleepwalk through it because, like, as you guys say, it's the most generic movie possible. It does absolutely nothing with the place or the concept, frankly. There's nothing interesting about the characters who we're watching on screen. There's no real questioning of our presumptions. And what's kind of interesting about Berg is that he has a way of playing with these genre films in a way that is designed to kind of undermine how they work normally. So I mentioned that piece by Very, Very Bad Things that we ran last week on the site. And Very Bad Things is a fascinating movie because it is 100% a subversion of the bro comedy. It takes all of these terrible people doing terrible things and amps it all up to 11, but makes it feel real in a way that makes you kind of like look at horror in all of these other movies that you have found funny and kind of amusing and charming over the years. He did a similar sort of thing in Hancock. Hancock is a superhero movie about a superhero who has decided to say F it and let himself go and doesn't really want to be heroic anymore. And it kind of examines that whole phenomenon of the, you know, the kind of superpowered savior figure and what it does to him and what it means to the community surrounding him in a way that very few other superhero pictures have interrogated. And even a movie like Mile 22, which is the most recent Mark Wahlberg, Peter Berg team up. It's a movie. It's kind of pitched as this American super team of, you know, military spies go around kicking down doors and saving bad guys from the Russians and blah blah. But it's actually a movie about blowback. The whole film is actually a movie about how that sort of thing is bad and unthinking aggression is going to end up biting you in the rear. And then you've got this movie, which is again, as you guys say, paint by numbers, generic, and just with nothing interesting about it. And this is why I like. I agree with you, Peter, that like Six Underground is the most Michael Bay movie that Michael Bay could make right now. Right, that's like the most Michael Bay movie that you could see at the budget he wants to work with. And Cuarón is making his like big personal movies, and you know Scorsese is making The Irishman, which is something he was trying to make for a decade. Blah blah blah. But like this sort of thing, it really strikes me as just lazy.
And even David Ayer with Bright. Who, I mean, Ayer is a kind of LA gritty LA cop movie guy, and he just made that gritty LA cop movie, but with orcs.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for Bright, which I think more or less works. And I know I'm alone on that, but
we're all alone.
I'm alone on a lot of things. We're all alone.
You've been
alone
socially
together.
Distancing your movie opinions for a long time.
It's also
I'm
just
used to this.
It's also just worth noting what just a horrible waste of a cast this is. I mean, this is a movie that has Mark Wahlberg, Winston Duke, Alan Arkin. I apologize for referring to him as Alan Alda earlier. I am brain dead because I'm in quarantine. This has Bokeem Woodbine, Mark Maron. I mean, it's really, it's a good cast, and this is unfortunate. I mean, it is hilarious having Marc Maron in this as, like, a former Boston Globe reporter for who got fired because he's, like, too real. But just, what? That's terrible. And we talked about Deepwater Horizon last week, which is a movie that demonstrates that, you know, Pete Berg is good at casting movies and then finding something useful for sort of everyone to do. And this is almost like an inverse Peter Berg movie. It's nonspecific. It has no material worth commenting on for anyone. It's bizarre.
So here's my exit question here, and I have a theory about why this sort of movie doesn't really work for Netflix in the way that that some of their other stuff does. And that's because, look, this is the sort of movie that you have to train people to go to want to watch, right? Like, this is a movie that you have to run 100 ads for and get people to be like, oh yeah, Mark Wahlberg's in that cop movie. That's a thing I'm going to go see this weekend. And when you don't have that sort of advertising campaign, it doesn't make any sense to make this sort of movie. And I think this has broader implications beyond Netflix, which is that I don't think this sort of movie would work on VOD either. Who is going to... How do you attract a big enough audience to pay for the $40 or $50 million this movie probably cost, if not more than that, on VOD without a huge advertising campaign to say, yeah, you love Mark Wahlberg, you got to go see this new Mark Wahlberg movie in your home, and you got to pay $20 for it, right? Like, the only reason the studios have been able to get away with this $20 price point is because they're putting out movies that were in theaters or were going to be in theaters that people knew about. And I don't think you can replicate that going forward, with the very rare exceptions of your MCU type movies, maybe your Christopher Nolan's, whatever, which I think is a real problem for the industry, looping back to our discussion about exhibition and streaming.
I think they do have an advertising platform and they used it, because for 2 weeks, every single time I logged into Netflix, it tried to get me to watch Spencer Confidential. And that was starting several days, if not a week or so, before the movie came out. And the front page of Netflix, the login page, which is nominally tailored to your individual interests, but we know they also just override the algorithm a lot. There are stories of Netflix setting up the individual directors' front pages to make sure that their movies are highlighted and featured, just to make those directors feel good when they log in. But they can use that front page to push new products out to a very large viewer base. They did that with Bright. That was how I found out that Bright was coming out. I'd heard in the trades that it was being produced, but I had just like an incredibly huge amount of advertisement direct from Netflix every time I was on, and I'd log in at least once a day. And I had the same thing with Spencer Confidential. I do agree that there is an issue with advertising, but part of that is TV's a little weird right now. Ad spends are a little weird right now. And also, nobody's out and about, so we're not seeing billboards. And billboards, especially in Los Angeles, are actually a way that you generate public knowledge for films. And I would bet that in a normal environment, a non-apocalypse environment, you would see an awful lot of Netflix spend on giant billboards for Spencer Confidential. And maybe even in LA, there are some that got put up that we just haven't seen because we're all East Coasters. Or I guess we're East Coasters plus Texas.
Yeah. You speak for yourself. I live in the heartland now. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Save yourself. Just don't. No. Down.
I have to say that I also watched Bloodshot with Vin Diesel, which went almost direct to video about a week ago. And it wasn't great, but it was better than this. Thumbs down.
All right. Thumbs down for me, too. All right. On to assigned viewing. Peter, why are we watching 28 Days Later?
Today we are watching 28 Days Later, the 2002 British zombie film directed by Danny Boyle and written by Alex Garland, because Alex Garland is also the writer and director of Devs. It's a TV show that's currently airing on FX on Hulu, and we're going to be watching it next week. Like Devs, 28 Days Later is a chilly, harrowing movie about how difficult it is to maintain a moral compass in a world without rules. It is bleak, harrowing, philosophically intriguing, and incredibly effective, I think, on both a visceral and intellectual level. I love this movie. I have loved this movie since it came out, and I like it for a bunch of reasons. One is that it's just just a great, scary, tense, low-budget horror film that really makes the most of its concept. It has some incredibly jaw-dropping shots of an empty London. It's a starkly beautiful film that really captures the eeriness of empty streets, an eeriness that is fairly familiar right now. And that is especially impressive considering how small the budget was. Another is the way that it treats its characters and their relationships, and the ways that it introduces levity and moments of hope, even in the midst of incredible despair. This is a dark film, like I said, but it's not just a downer. There's just sort of constantly sort of will balance the darkness with moments of like, okay, we're surviving and we're enjoying our lives and we're trying to find some way to make us make ourselves happy. There's this great little bit with where they go to a grocery store and find it completely stocked and full, and there's no zombies in it, and there's even lights on, and they can just sort of like run around the grocery store and enjoy not normal life, but something pleasurable for a moment. And that's, I think, you know, sort of a given where we are at today. I think that's a very real thing and a smart thing to put into the movie. That said, it's a very dark movie. It goes some very dark places and has a fairly dark view of human nature, or at least the way that human nature can go. And I think it may not be for everyone. Alyssa, I'm particularly interested in how you felt about it and how you feel about where it goes in the third act.
I loved it. I thought it, I had not actually watched it before this, because as longtime listeners of this podcast know, I am a total coward. But I thought it was wonderful. And you know, that balance of emotions that you talk about, I think is the thing that makes it work. You know, it's a movie where Cillian Murphy's Jim goes from apologizing for lashing out sort of instinctively against this priest who's infected to, you know, defending his friends in a way that is so savage and scary that Naomi Harris's character has this moment where she thinks that he's gone, you know, fully feral. But because you get those moments of kindness and also just the real sort of beauty of England, it's bearable, right? I mean, it's a movie about, and the characters return over and over to the question of whether there is more than simply surviving. And the movie, in its structure, in its visuals, just tells you yes over and over again. It may not be a lot more, but there's more, and it's worth hanging on to. I mean, I think that, you know, in the last third of the movie, I was joking about it in English right manner in our introduction. Again, part of the reason that that whole sequence is bearable is because of the casting of Christopher Eccleston as West, the army officer who has been broadcasting this signal to try and attract women to this manor where his men are holed up, because he thinks that if he can find them women to have relationships with, coerced or no, that they'll have some sense of the future. And Eccleston is an actor of unbelievable sort of core decency. I don't know if folks have watched his run as Doctor Who, as the Doctor in Doctor Who, but, you know, he is someone who, even when he's playing characters who have done really bad things, and he actually does that fairly often, he's really good at conveying sort of the struggle to be good and the, you know, the sort of, he's good at conveying motivation. And so part of what works about this sequence, which would be just unbearable otherwise, is the fact that you know, Eccleston conveys that West is trying to save his men and that he believes that this is the only way to prevent them from suicide and worse atrocities. And he's done a terrible thing. He continues to do terrible things, but his motivations separate him from the zombies that he's trying to defend against. And I mean, it's a performance that just, I think, works really well and is a sign of the movie's overall sense of balance. You don't have to forgive him. You don't have to forgive his men. You can think it's good that they all end up as zombie fodder, but what they are doing is still a really essentially human thing in a way that I think is compelling and makes that section of the movie something that you can get through.
He's trying to set up a situation where they can do a thing that is essentially inhumane, but in a humane way. And he's kind of confusing the way you go about doing something with the thing itself in a way that is philosophically interesting as Alex Garland's work often is.
I'm a big fan of this movie, and I find it interesting to compare to 28 Weeks Later, which is a movie I also like, but I don't think it's quite as good for a couple reasons.
But it's fine, but it's not nearly as good.
Yeah, the main among them is that, ironically, 28 Days Later is a much better movie about 9/11 than 28 Weeks Later is, which was explicitly set up as a parable for 9/11. So 28 Days Later was in pre-production, had been written, I believe, before 9/11 happened, any of that. It came out in 2002, I want to say. Or maybe 2003. I should have looked that up before we started talking. But it is a movie that is very evocative of 9/11 with the kind of empty streets and with the whole idea of, you know, people turning on themselves and turning on each other and also finding solidarity in a time of crisis like this. Whereas 28 Weeks Later is like, it has all of these like very specific 9/11 war on terror references, like to the Green Zone, and it involves the American occupation of a city that has torn itself apart, et cetera, et cetera. And it actually fails as a 9/11 metaphor because it is so specific and weirdly kind of like on the nose. I don't know. I like 28 Days Later a lot. I'm a huge Danny Boyle and Alex Garland fan, and I think that their collaborations in the late 90s, early aughts were, you know, very, very fruitful and productive. The one thing I do actually kind of love about this is, and it's a sly little thing, is the way the rage virus is actually released by animal rights activists, which I thought was like a nice little grace note.
And also I definitely made a note of that while watching that this morning.
That, once again, environmentalists, they make the best villains. And the other thing that is kind of amusing is in the supermarket, right? When they're going through the fresh fruit, they find the fruit that had been irradiated, right, and was still good to eat, whereas the other one was moldy. And like it's this weird little like. Again, it's like a weird little grace note that, you know, a lot of people probably don't pick up on, but as somebody who's hopelessly had his brain warped by politics, I couldn't help but see and be like, oh, that's funny. That's a funny little dig. So I loved it, and I'm quite enjoying Devs, which we are watching now.
Yeah, we'll talk more about Devs next week, but I was just thinking a lot about Alex Garland while watching this, and in retrospect, I've always thought of this as a Danny Boyle movie and as essentially a Danny Boyle movie. And now it kind of seems to me a little more like Alex Garland is the real author of 28 Days Later and the more important creator. Because if you compare, it's not that Danny Boyle's not important at all, but it just feels to me like Garland has been sort of working with this big question of what do people do when the old order falls away for a long time. And that goes back to his work as a novelist where he wrote The Beach, which is kind of about a backpacker camp where the rules don't apply anymore and where people kind of think they're finding a freedom. But of course, in that freedom, from governments and from this outside society also become kind of awful and, you know, sort of do some terrible things to each other. And you see that two in his debut work as a movie director, Ex Machina, and again in Annihilation, where Annihilation is literally about a journey into a place where the rules of physics don't apply and where people become part of their environment as a result. And so he's really interrogating in ways that I think are just absolutely fascinating the nature of morality and the nature of kind of consciousness and intention, right? Like, what is it? Well, you know, sometimes you might mean to do one thing, but you're doing something else. This comes into play a lot in Devs, which is a little bit of a different sort of story about the end of a social order. But seeing that, and also seeing the way that he deals with female characters and male-female relationships. And Naomi Harris's character in this movie is a great character and also a really interesting character to think of when you see Ex Machina and Annihilation and Devs as well, all of which really deal with kind of the female experience in ways that are somewhat unusual and provocative.
Yeah, and I think part of what works about the way Harris's character is written in this movie is that in a lot of writers and directors' hands, she would have been, and I'm putting this in air quotes, a strong female character. In other words, a character who is essentially a man, except that she has a woman's body and wears, you know, women's clothes. And, you know, here she is, she's more ruthless than a lot of the other characters, in part because she thinks she has to be. She is extremely competent, but she's also incredibly nurturing. I mean, one of the things that's incredibly moving about the sequence at the manor at the end is that, you know, that she understands what's coming. She understands that she and Hannah, this young girl, are both going to be raped. And her first instinct is to help Hannah survive it, right? I mean, she gets one of the soldiers out of the room so Hannah can at least have that last moment of dignity while she's changing into the clothes that the soldiers want her to wear. She gives her a tranquilizer so she'll be detached. And there's this moment when Hannah says, "Are you trying to kill me?" And Harris kisses her really tenderly and, you know, "No, I'm trying to sort of make it so it doesn't matter, so you don't feel anything." And it is so loving and tender. And the fact that, you know, Garland and Boyle understand that those impulses
and kind of wise, and, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a sense of like, I'm older and I've been through some very hard things and I have,
yeah,
some,
and maybe, you know, even
this is the way,
but
to
I also,
the unsurvival.
but also that I understand that what's about to happen to you is in some ways worse than anything that's happened to you before. And I understand that in a very specific way because I am a woman and I am older. And it's just, it's wonderful writing. It's wonderful acting by Harris. And it just shows a real, I think, a deep understanding of sort of the female experience that you wouldn't necessarily expect to crop up in a movie like this, but that it's, you know, it's one of the things that I'm really glad it's there.
Great. All right. That's it for today's show. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. Just remember, 2 months free. Just look in the box in the top top left-hand corner for a link to the deal. If you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. And if we don't grow, we'll die. We're kind of like sharks. And review us at Apple, subscribe, etc., etc. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show on your phone and on your computer and all the other places you listen to podcasts now, since we don't listen to them in cars. Don't listen to me at the gym anymore. I'll see you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman, produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta, executive producer Dallas Sonier, associate producer Jessica Safavamare, art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.